having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and its Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral session docket. In the order of their appearance, they are 050892, N. Ray McCallum Medical Center, Inc., doing business as McCallum Medical Center and Universal Health Services, Inc., an original proceeding. Docket number 050956, James Vandevender versus the Honorable G. Mitch Woods in his official capacity as Sheriff of Jefferson County, Texas, and Jefferson County, Texas, from Jefferson County in the 9th Court of Appeals District. And 051092, Russell Gaines and Southwest Guarantee Mortgage Corporation from Johnson County and the 10th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument and expects to conclude all arguments before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050892 N. Ray McCallum Medical Center.
May it please the court, I'd like to address two issues this morning. The first one, why an appeal is not an adequate remedy for the erroneous denial of a dismissal motion under the Medical Liability Insurance Improvement Act when the lack of an adequate report shows that the case is now meritless. The second issue is whether Dr. Brown, a sporadically employed general practitioner in family medicine with utterly no hospital credentials, is somehow qualified by training or experience to render an opinion on cardiovascular surgery, that's heart bypass surgery, carotid artery surgery, or credentialing surgeons who do perform those proceedings, when she does not state that she has any training in those procedures or activities or has ever even done them. The first issue about adequate remedy of law and the prudential in the AIU cases, the courts detailed some very specific elements to go through in order to determine the practicality of the adequacy of the remedy. On the public side, the public factor, the court takes a look at whether the proceeding is now simply a waste of time and a burden on the court system and the public. The court looks at whether granting an opinion now will provide important guidance to the court and whether it will avoid providing any temptation to the legislature for creating yet another ground of interlocutory appeal. On the private side, the court looks at whether this might all just shake out and become harmless error and whether it is a temptation to the courts of appeal to micromanage trial court practice. Another element is whether the nature of the right is such that postponing any remedy renders the right an illusion and denies the full effect of the right. And then the last factor is whether then the what will be coldly reversible error, what kind of tool will that become in the hands of the opposing party. Here, there are three intersecting things, all of which are legislative policies that I think strongly favor in finding there is no adequate remedy by appeal. The first one is an announced policy by the legislature that if you don't have an expert in these cases, you don't have a case. It's meritless. It needs to be out of the system. The second is another announced policy by the legislature that there's more than the interests of the litigants and more than just one individual court's time at stake. It's a matter of public health, that the costs of these suits are being transferred through insurance to the doctors, who in turn react by either curtailing services, leaving the area, or raising rates to the public, none of which help public health. The third is also a legislative finding that the current remedies for disposing of such cases are inadequate to the task, and that the only remedy which serves not just the interests of the litigants and the trial courts, but public health in general, is to get these cases out of the system within 6 months. That's the remedy that works.
The legislature looked at all of those factors that you talked about, pointed to, and they're certainly supported in the legislative record. But then in the amendment to 4590I, MLIA, the legislature did not provide that these matters should be reviewed on mandamus. It easily could have, couldn't it? Or it could have made the interlocutory appeal retroactive, couldn't it?
Well, they could have done that, but I think if the legislature, given the situation at the time, had entertained that notion, it would have said it's not necessary. The first thing is that at the time the legislature approached this thing, back in 2002, only two courts of appeal had addressed these issues, and both of them had said there is a remedy by mandamus. Therefore, if the legislature had acted at all, it would have had to say that we're going to abolish the remedy that the courts have already created. There would have been no necessity to go ahead and create a statute that says, yeah, retroactively we're going to allow mandamuses, when that remedy already existed. The courts have plainly said that. The second thing is, what you would then suppose is that the legislature had first made a decision that these cases are meritless, they need to be removed from the system, but we're now going to have a bifurcated system. Cases before 2003, we won't allow any appellate review and we'll just allow all the harm to the public to occur, but cases after 2003, we want to have the appeal so that happen. That, I think, would be attributing certain motives to the legislature which just don't reflect in the entire scheme. The entire scheme is to get them out of the system. I think the sounder assumption is the court decided to create an appeal for the new cases and perpetuate the old one, not abolish it. Putting
the
another
legislature.
Way, I'm sorry.
You mean the legislature?
Legislature, yes. If they wanted to abolish it, they would have done what they did in several other statutes, which is to say there will be no mandamus and no appeal. I think that's what they would have done if that's what they'd intended. Rather than, put it another way, there is no sense, it's hard to find a legislative rationale or purpose to having a bifurcated system.
The elements that you recite in favor of mandamus here,
yes.
Which of those was not present in N. Ray Woman's Hospital of Texas?
Well, all of the situation hasn't changed, if that's the nature of the question. At the time the N. Ray Women's Hospital was decided, the legislature had already acted.
But all of the elements that you recite for compelling mandamus applied equally in those cases.
Yes. All the elements that I'm talking about existed at that time.
And this court declined to review them by mandamus.
A majority declined to review by mandamus, but as the court later on said, and I believe it was AIU, the denial of mandamus is not precedent.
But it's a pretty strong indication, is it not? If the same elements were present here or present there, is that a pretty strong indication that the Supreme Court didn't consider those reviewable on mandamus?
The only thing I can say is that if that were the case, then the majority would have written an opinion plainly saying this is the case. There are lots of reasons to not grant mandamus. As I've often been told, the court may just not view this as the appropriate case to take up the issue at this time. There may be a lot of reasons that don't have anything to do with the adequacy of remedy by appeal that might influence a majority not to choose this particular case. It's like the denial of a petition for review. One can't say that the majority has agreed with any particular rationale whatsoever. The other thing of it is, since that time, we've had the two opinions in Prudential and AIU, which set out these factors.
When you go through the statutes and even some of our rules, you can find legislature saying the trial court must dismiss, shall dismiss, must grant, shall grant in various contexts. And many of them have the same factors that you mentioned. The reality of a useless appeal because let's take a no evidence summary judgment motion, for example. If there's no evidence presented, the respondent doesn't present evidence in response to a no evidence summary judgment motion, the trial court shall grant the motion. If the court doesn't grant the motion, what happens? Do we have mandamus jurisdiction or the right to issue mandamus in those cases?
No, if you mean in the case, for example, the no evidence summary judgment, no, I would say not in those cases.
What if it's a billion-dollar case?
Not in that case. And I would say it goes not to the amount of money involved, but the nature of the right that's being denied. In the N. Ray Ford about the legislative continuance case, one could have made exactly the same statement about being denied a legislative continuance. But because it was a statutory right at issue, and one which I think is pretty obvious, it's a little hard to give that back on appeal, and the public's right was involved, the court didn't say, is it possible that we can somehow cobble together some sort of remedy on appeal to restore this? The court said, is it going to give full effect to the statutory remedy to deny any remedy until appeal? And the plain answer was no.
Well, there are examples where the legislature thinks it's important enough to write within the statute an interlocutory appellate right. The chapter, is it 51, the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, police jurisdiction, other
yes.
You know, things like that, where the legislature contemplates it and says, okay, in this case, we're going to give the losing party the right to go to the appellate court and challenge this. And in fact, as Justice Wainwright mentioned, that's what the legislature ultimately did with these expert report cases. But in the absence of that, where do we find this? Is it just in AIU? Is that what you're saying?
I think in AIU, they set out the factors. And in Prudential, the factors were set out. But the arguments I'm raising were the same sort of thing raised in the Ford case and also in the Proper case. It's not just an analysis of what kind of remedy can we fashion, but whether the nature of the right permits postponement to be any kind of remedy whatsoever. And obviously the denial of a continuance to the legislature doesn't remedy the client who's left in the lurch, and it doesn't remedy the public who may be denied their legislature. In the Proffer case, the question of statutory venue, which in a child termination case has to be decided immediately at the beginning, and the court said that you can't postpone an erroneous venue ruling until later because of the important interest. Taking the child out of the home, and that if, in other words, the speedy remedy is necessary to make the process work and to allow the vindication of the rights of keeping the family together. And then
have you ever heard of a medical malpractice case before with 224 patients filing suit against one doctor?
Not anywhere.
Have you ever seen one in Texas in 150 years?
Not so.
Does that make this case unusual from all the other run-of-the-mill medical malpractice cases where one patient sues one doctor?
Yes, it's almost a class action medical malpractice case.
Well, how's that any different from a multi-plaintiff lawsuit against a toxic tort involving toxic torts? What's the difference there? You got 100 plaintiffs versus one company, one defendant. Significantly different than that, other than the number of parties involved.
Well, it's different in the sense that in a product liability, you have one product which hopefully is manufactured the same way in every situation, so that by identifying a defect in one product, you will determine whether it's defective and caused the injury to these people. In a medical malpractice case, you're talking about different procedures done on different people under different circumstances in 220 different cases.
Maybe, maybe not.
Well,
you want us to carve out an exception for this case. Not an exception for other cases like that involving different defendants.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. You want us to carve out an exception for your case and not other cases involving similar type of number of plaintiffs and singular defendants.
Well, in one sense, it already was. This happened in the area of special appearances where the court started off saying, oh, we're always going to say that this remedy is adequate by appeal, and we're just going to review the denial of a special appearance on appeal. And then along came a case where you had a multitude of defendants and a multitude of plaintiffs, the national sand case, and they said, well, this we can't remedy. And then there was the next case, I believe the CSR case, where you had an Australian company who was being brought in on very tenuous grounds on jurisdiction and to face asbestos cases, for which we had thousands in the system. And then we said, oh, well, now that is an exceptional case. So I would think the answer is, in the area of special exceptions, we've already begun to carve out those kinds of exceptions, that they can't, that the sheer multitude or the number of cases can create the exception where perhaps one individual case might not.
From your perspective, what is the primary test in this case that should be applied for determining whether there's an adequate remedy on appeal?
I think because that there is a statutory system with very distinct legislative goals in mind. It's the first thing is set in for it. The question to ask is anything else going to give full effect to the system? The second thing is that the legislature has plainly said there is a public health aspect to this. It's not just the litigants. There are harms that will occur to the public that will occur before there can ever be any appeal.
If we do not decide this issue on mandamus, you'll still have an appeal.
Yes.
And you can still, from your perspective, I think you believe the case from reading your brief is winnable on your side. You can still win it on appeal. So you said earlier that sometimes postponing the remedy denies the right. How would postponing a remedy on appeal deny the right of getting a dismissal under the statute, if you're correct?
Well, this goes back to postponing the right to whom? There is a public issue. The public is injured because all the costs are put off on them and doctors curtail their remedies or they curtail their services and they leave the area, which is what the legislature found was going on in the valley 3 years ago. That we never get back. The second thing of it is, which was talked about in AIU, is the possibility that now that there's cold reversible error in the case, that becomes the bludgeon by which the other side uses to leverage unfair settlements. What do you do when they say, okay, it's going to cost $150,000 to try each one of these cases, but then the plaintiff comes in and says, but we'll offer to settle for $75,000. Well, then the insurance company or the guarantee association or whatever will look at this as dollars and cents. They'll pay it. And then the harm that the legislature didn't want to happen, which is to pass the cost of defending meritless suits, actually then does occur.
Are there any further questions?
I'm sorry, I did go over it.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. The court is now ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Wingate, with an argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court.
Have you ever heard of a medical malpractice case with 224 patients in it suing one doctor?
Well, I suppose we could have filed 220 individual lawsuits.
That's what everybody else in Texas does, isn't it?
Well, we certainly cut down a little bit of cost by combining them all in one lawsuit.
Have you ever heard of a suit where 224 medical malpractice plaintiffs were combined in one filing fee, one case?
No, I have not.
Anything close to it?
No. But there is a big reason that this court should not order the trial court to dismiss this case at this point in the proceedings, and that is because there is a pending motion for a grace period under subdivision G of section 1301 that the trial court has not yet ruled on, and that affects
How long has it been pending?
I'm sorry?
How long has it been pending?
Since the day of the hearing on the motion to dismiss. We timely filed it.
How long?
Is that 5 years? 5 years?
Yes. Yes, but...
Five and a half.
When is the trial judge ever going to try this case? And how are you going to try 224 separate medical malpractice cases?
Nobody
has any idea.
There aren't 220 plaintiffs anymore.
How many are there now?
There's one.
One. All 223 have settled.
Many have been dismissed. Many have been non-suited. Some have been dismissed on summary judgment. There's a settlement pending. So there's really just one.
There's one plaintiff or one patient
one patient,
they the same?
One plaintiff.
Are you sure about that, or is that what the motion to abate is about?
That's what the motion to abate is about.
So, in fact, you might be wrong about that.
Well, I think that the trial court has to make that decision in
How
the first
instance. How many years is that going to take?
I'm sorry?
How many years is that going to take?
You know, I can't tell you. But I'd encourage you to look at the record and look at the docket sheet and look at the numerous motions for summary judgment that were on the judge's plate for the past 5 years and look to see if there are any filings by...
The rules of judicial administration are supposed to move this case, a case through in 18 months.
Right, but I...
Which we're...
Three or four times over.
I'm just wondering why this was done this way. I understand, the argument is, you know, this is... We can't be involved and button into, you know, interlocutory matters in the trial court. This is very unusual.
It is, but I respectfully submit that it's not our fault that the trial court took so long.
Nobody insisted that you file all 224 claims in one case.
No, but there were exceptional circumstances that justified filing it that way. We were running up on limitations. We had elderly patients. We had deceased patients with family members who couldn't remember when and where exactly that they had received treatment, and we were having trouble getting medical records. We were running up on a statute of limitations, and the magnitude of the harm that was caused by this doctor required us to preserve our client's rights and file the suit this way. But I'd like to get back on the issue of the 1301G motion, because it affects...
Let me just clarify one thing. You say there's one plaintiff left.
Yes.
But even absent the motion to abate, there are only 11 or 12 left, even absent that, right?
That's right. 10.
And that's undisputed.
That's undisputed. The pending motion for a grace period under Subdivision G affects both elements of the standard for granting mandamus. And the reason is because when we filed a timely 13.01G motion, the trial court had no duty to dismiss the case until it determined that that motion was meritless, or if it granted the motion, that we failed to comply with the grace period. And second, it affects whether there are exceptional circumstances in this case and whether the legislature's intent is really thwarted by the failure to dismiss this case at the present time. The way this works is that a dismissal for an inadequate report is always subject to the mandatory grace period under Subdivision G if a timely filed and properly supported motion is filed at the proper time. We filed a motion the day of the hearing, and the court took it up. Mr. Hughes asked the court to continue the hearing on that motion because he said, and he was correct, there's no reason to rule on the extension if you find that the reports are adequate, which the trial court did. At the present
time, if the trial court has denied the motion to dismiss, right?
Right.
So what's left of the motion for a grace period? Why would you need a grace period if the trial judge is not going to dismiss the case?
That's exactly the point.
Are you saying that the motion for a grace period is pending and that should inhibit review of the case? But why, if the motion for dismissal has been denied?
Well, let's think about it. The relators are asking this court to issue an order directing the trial court at this point in the proceedings to dismiss the lawsuit with prejudice. And that cuts off our statutory right to have our motion heard and ruled upon.
But there's nothing to grant. Why would the trial court grant it?
Well, you're right. But if this court finds that the expert reports were inadequate, then we have a right to come back and say, well, wait a second. This was not the result of conscious indifference, but rather was the result of accident or mistake. And if the trial court, in his discretion, finds that that's correct, it's mandatory that he grants a 30-day grace period.
But he's already found that it's okay. The report's okay.
Exactly. Exactly. He agreed with us. It punishes the plaintiff when the trial court agrees that the expert reports are adequate, because if the trial court had found they were inadequate, it would have proceeded to determine our motion to extend time.
Would you make the same argument if there was a motion for continuance on a summary judgment ruling that you lost? You can't enter a final order dismissing the case because we want to go back down to the trial court and get more evidence. We have a motion for continuance pending.
Well, if
that argument taken to its logical conclusion gives everybody a right to a second bite at the apple.
Well, it's a statutorily created right to a second bite at the apple. I think that the legislature's purpose was to dismiss frivolous lawsuits, not to dismiss meritorious lawsuits on a technicality. That's why they gave and the right to a grace period. And I think in your hypothetical, I think what you're saying is when the person responding to the motion for summary judgment moves for a continuance, and you said it was denied.
No, the motion. The motion for summary judgment was granted.
And the motion for summary judgment was granted. Well, the case, that's not like our facts here because the motion for the motion to dismiss was not granted.
Ms. Wingate, I've not read the amended statute. Is that same right with under subsection G in the statute that now allows an interlocutory appeal?
It absolutely is.
So if your argument is correct, then under this current statute, you could have an interlocutory appeal, as the legislature says, and if it comes up and we determine at that point through the Court of Appeals and this court that the expert report is bad, then we send it back down, and then the trial court gets to look and grant an extension, and then we start all over again.
Well,
because they grant the extension, they contest the report, and then we come right back up again. What am I missing?
Well,
in that
I think
theory?
That's addressed by the second part of the provision that grants the interlocutory appeal, which says that an interlocutory appeal will not lie when the trial court has granted an extension of time.
Okay, but we're not granting one now.
Right.
I'm saying under the new statute.
What I think it envisions is expert report filed, motion to dismiss filed, and before the motion is heard, if there's a motion to extend time, then the court proceeds to the hearing. If the court determines that the case should not be dismissed because even though the expert report is adequate, but there are grounds for an extension, the court grants an extension. You only get one. So if by the end of that extension you haven't complied with the statute, an order finally dismissing should be entered. And if it's not interlocutory, okay.
Let's go back to my question. Under the new statute, and I know it's not in this case.
Right.
If there is an interlocutory appeal and it comes all the way through the Supreme Court and we determine that it's a bad report and goes back to the trial court, does the trial court under the new statute, under your theory as you're arguing now in this case, the trial court then can grant an extension, get a new report filed, and then if the trial court rules, then we have the interlocutory process again?
No.
Or is there something that will not let it function like that?
Well, yes. The motion has to be filed before the motion for a grace period.
But the question I'm going to is this. After it goes back down, the trial court, under your theory, gets a chance to give an extension.
The motion to grant a grace period has to be filed before the hearing on the motion to dismiss. So the trial court's on notice of whether or not he can grant an extension. And if no motion is properly filed, there's no extension.
Wouldn't someone always file a motion? Why would they not file a motion if there's a motion to dismiss?
Well, I think they have a legal obligation not to file a motion that's not properly supported.
And in a summary judgment case where there's interlocutory appeal, like immunities, you would always file a motion for continuance, just in case, so that if the trial judge is wrong in denying the summary judgment to dismiss the case, it goes up on appeal. Judge, I've got a motion for continuance pending. I also get another bite at the apple.
But you don't have the statutory right to a continuance. It's discretionary. There is a statutory right. The statute says the court shall grant a grace period.
We provide for continuances for summary judgments in the rules of civil procedure, which are co-equal to statutes.
Right, but it's not mandatory.
Procedures in our courts.
It's not mandatory.
Mr. Hughes says this case is different because you're looking at societal interests. There is a medical malpractice crisis. Doctors are fleeing areas of the state because of that crisis, because frivolous lawsuits are brought. And because of that, among other factors, this is a case that is primed for mandamus review. What's your response?
My response is that there is no guarantee that this lawsuit cannot be dismissed in the future. Presumably, if this case really is frivolous, we are not going to be able to find an expert who can comply with the statute at the end of the grace period. And at that point, the trial court should dismiss the case. There's still the possibility it could get dismissed.
Do you think Dr. Brown satisfies the requirements?
I think she does.
Well, then why look for anybody else?
Well, that's the point. The trial court agreed with us.
Right.
So, but we would if we're entitled to the grace period. So,
this dispute's been going on for 5 years. I mean, her letters are from actually 6 years ago.
Right.
You know, haven't made any backup plans over the 6 years. Busy with other stuff.
Well, it's not in the record, but we have had other doctors review Ms. Reyes, the only remaining plaintiff, her file. And we do think we don't think there's any evidence in this record that her claims are frivolous.
Who gains if, of course, it's been the law for 100 years, you got to have an expert in a medical malpractice case. If you don't, you lose. Who gains if we go all the way to instructed verdict and there is, it turns out, nothing but this, and the trial judge decides it's not enough? Aren't we all better off knowing now?
Well, I think that presumes that this expert and these claims were frivolous, and I think that the legislature did intend to dismiss frivolous claims to reduce the burden on the public, but they also recognize that in some instances counsel may have a mistake, opposing counsel may cause the mistake, may cause the party to be unable to file an adequate report, and in those cases, a meritorious claim would get dismissed.
But tying together with my previous questions, there do seem to be a remarkable and unusual number of cases with hundreds of plaintiffs in one suit in South Texas. There's some doubt about whether, in some instances, those cases are really intended to go to trial or intended to pressure a settlement. In which case you don't need a trial. You don't want it, may not even want a trial. But the longer you can keep the case going, the more expensive it is for the defendants, and they might have to settle. Not saying that's your case, but shouldn't courts be concerned about that when looking at whether appeals an adequate remedy? If in fact there's some reason to suspect going to trial and going to an appeal is not even contemplated.
Well, maybe if at the point that the court is ruling, there's still a possibility that 200 some odd plaintiffs could actually go to trial. There's only one plaintiff that could possibly go to trial here, and the rest of the suit has been dismissed.
Let me ask you about that. We know now the legislature wants all of them appealed. They've said interlocutory appeal in every case, right?
Right.
So isn't that a legislative finding that in fact never in these cases on this issue is appeal an adequate remedy?
No.
Why would they pass the statute that every one of them can be appealed interlocutory if they thought appeal was ever an adequate remedy?
Well, as was said earlier, the legislature certainly knows how to apply the statute retroactively, and actually to apply this particular statute, the interlocutory appeal statute, to cases that are pending on the date that the law changes.
That
would have applied to our case.
Well, but you can't just apply everything retroactively because you want to. There's constitutional rights that are involved when you change the law on people that have already filed suits. So they might have been concerned about something like that. I'm just asking for, there's no question when they say every one of these has a right to an interlocutory appeal. There's no question they believe from this effective date forward, appeal is never an adequate remedy on this issue. Otherwise, they wouldn't have passed the statute.
Well, I don't think that you can necessarily infer that because...
Which exceptions did they make to it?
I'm sorry?
They made no exceptions to it.
No, there is an exception that if they're...
under this statute, you don't even need a clear abuse of discretion. The judge can be exactly right that the report's perfectly adequate, and you still get an interlocutory appeal and tie up the case for that long, don't you?
Only
if there's no clear abuse of discretion.
I'm sorry?
They don't say you get an interlocutory appeal if there's been a clear abuse of discretion. They say everybody gets an interlocutory appeal.
That puts the cart before the horse. That makes you decide whether the trial court abused its discretion before you get to appeal.
Well, that's what we do.
It doesn't say that anywhere.
But that's what we do on mandamus.
Right, but
we don't fool around with a mandamus if we can look at it and say this is closed or this is easy. We don't have to do it. But now the legislature said you get to do all of them.
Well, the legislature has also come back in other cases, like what Mr. Hughes pointed out with the family code. The legislature has come back after a case that said mandamus is available to remedy this. The legislature has come back and codified that. They did it. I'm about to run out of time, I see, but they did it in the family code section 263.304, the exact provision that he was referring to after N. Ray Collin and after I think it was N. Ray Bishop, where the court said we're going to grant mandamus for this because we want the trial court to proceed to judgment within the timing deadlines. The legislature came back and said we're going to grant mandamus for this because we think that's right, and they didn't do that here.
Ms. Wingate, do you think there are any situations where a trial court's denial of a motion to dismiss on the grounds of 4590I should be mandamusable?
You know, I think that given that many of these cases, there aren't that many cases that are left.
This and we're is just old. Looking at cases still in the pipeline.
This
That's
is old
true.
Law. You know,
any
this,
situations.
This is an old case, and I just don't see this issue coming up. And I think that mandamus should be reserved for extraordinary circumstances. And given the fact that this case, if it's decided in the relator's favor, really isn't going to have that much effect in the future, I think no, it shouldn't be granted.
So you think there are no situations where these type matters should be heard on mandamus?
No.
Ms. Wingate, if I can change your direction just a moment. Justice Heck asked you, and you responded, I think, about Ms. Brown's, Dr. Brown's qualifications.
Yes.
As I understand from the record, her experience has been in observing these different types of surgeries, but she's never performed one or had independent training in how to perform them. Is that correct?
That's right.
What's
just,
the difference
just like
between
the doctor who is actually performing
yeah,
them?
Well, what's the difference between her situation and a nurse practitioner or an operating room nurse who has watched these things go happen 100 of times? Is she differently situated from such a nurse who says, I've seen it, so I can tell when it's right and not?
Well, many of the statements in her expert report focus on post-operative care and nurse practitioners.
Okay, let's go simply to the operation, not the post-operative care. Mm-hmm. Is she in any different situation than a nurse who's observed hundreds of these surgeries being done insofar as her qualification, in your view, to be an expert witness on whether it's done right or wrong?
Well, I think
standard
that,
of care.
I think the statute requires when you're testifying against a physician that the expert be a physician. So yes.
Yeah, but I'm going
she's
to her she's a physician, no question about that. But her qualifications to testify if this doctor did the surgery correctly or incorrectly, is she better situated than a nurse who has seen it done over and over again, qualification wise, in your view?
Yes. Well, she is a medical doctor and she's been trained to recognize symptoms and also been trained to render post-operative care in similar
But the surgery itself, she's not had training.
That's right.
Okay, and so let's go to the post-op care, and I would ask the same question then. She is a physician. Is she better situated on these particular type patients, heart surgeries, the carotid artery surgery, is she better qualified, in your opinion, even though she hasn't had specific training in, than a nurse who has simply observed that care over and over again?
Yes, I believe so.
On what basis?
Because she's trained in the diagnosis of the indications for. I mean, a doctor is trained to recognize symptoms.
And so is a nurse.
And trained to seek consults for their patients.
Okay, and
the
nurse.
And in the course of that consulting process, they're still involved with the treatment, and a nurse practitioner probably isn't.
What is according to the briefs, quote, house call business in general medicine, close quote, that Dr. Brown was involved in after 2002, or from 2002 forward?
Well, I think it can be assumed. I mean, she treated elderly patients, so she visited them at home, and that's exactly the type of patients that brought the claim physician. Most of these patients were elderly.
So that's what she was called, a house call business in general medicine?
Yes.
And in what way, maybe it was in the brief, but I missed it, but what way did the medical center violate the law by hiring Bracamontes? I understand your claim that it violated its bylaws. I understand the claim. But how did it violate the law by hiring him? that's stated in the brief. I didn't see an explanation for how that occurred.
I'm going to have to apologize because I'm not sure the exact answer. My understanding is that that hospitals, I think, are prohibited from hiring doctors as employees by law, but I'm not sure if that's right. So I can provide a brief on that if you'd like.
I believe that's in the record. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Hughes, what business or duty does this court have, if any, in speculating what the intent of one plaintiff or 224 plaintiffs filing a lawsuit in South Texas, East Texas, North Texas, West Texas, or any part of the state? What business it is of this court to speculate what the intent of those parties is?
It becomes the business of the courts when the legislative requirement they provide an expert report is violated, because at that point the legislature says the case is meritless and should be out. And at that point, once they have failed to fulfill the statutory requirement to show their case has merit, then it is the court's business to remove. Their intent can be presumed.
Why can't the legislature just write a statute so there's no right of appeal? You go directly to mandamus proceeding. Is that in the statute?
That was not in the old statute. There was only two courts of appeals that determined that mandamus was an appropriate remedy when they changed the statute. When they changed the statute, they didn't abolish mandamus. They didn't enact it. They just left it as it was.
Let me run a hypothetical by you. Let's say the trial court in this case, instead of sitting on the motion for a grace period, had gone ahead and granted the grace period. And, I mean, you'd agree, and a new affidavit had been filed that you still thought was inadequate. Or let's say it did beat adequacy, but the granting of the grace period was erroneous, clearly erroneous. That would not be mandamusable, correct?
If my memory serves me correct, the courts of appeal have sort of split on that question. The ones that have reached, some of them said there is no adequate remedy, but then they generally go ahead and find no abuse of discretion. In other words, those that would find that mandamus is available generally go ahead and review it under an abuse of discretion test, and usually, you know, tie goes, in other words, as usual, if there's any thing to support it, then the trial court will win. And in most cases, the trial court wins because the motion has been adequately supported.
Well, are you aware of any case law that has said anything about that other than just simply denying mandamus? I mean, you're really kind of speculating on that, right?
I recall that some of them have addressed it, and that's why I said that they addressed it under the abuse of discretion standard rather than denied it under the abuse of discretion prong.
But the courts have said it is mandamusable?
I'd like to submit a post-submission brief, a letter brief on that, if it's fine. But I would say in this case, it would be an abuse of discretion, and I'd ask the court to take a look at their motion. Their motion only was, first, it was a conditional motion. It was only if you're going to grant their motion, then grant this one. But the point of it is it only gave two grounds. The first one is it said some of these people, we haven't gotten their medical records yet. But when you look at the record of the hearing, not one of those people are still around.
But rather than get to the merits of this motion, because I know your time is limited, you think there should be two different standards for granting of a grace period review versus inadequate report review?
There's not two different standards. The question is, if there is an abuse of discretion, then I think you'd have to drop back to see whether or not they have an adequate remedy for appeal.
Let me rephrase my question. The adequacy question would be the same. Whether in either instance,
whether, yes.
Okay, so you think that the denial of the grace period would be reviewable by mandamus as well?
Yes, and in this case, I think it's particularly telling that it's gone on for 4 years. They had an opportunity during the period to seek this, and they didn't. Their handwriting should have been on the wall when this court granted the petition, granted us leave to file the petition to go back to the trial court and say there's a problem. Maybe we should get this granted so that it won't drag on. Point is now exactly what the legislature shouldn't happen is going to happen. We'll be 5-6 years out, and we still won't have a report. And now we're no more delay.
Mr. Hughes, help me just a moment. You had 200 summary judgments in this case. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why are we here on mandamus 5 years later when you've taken the time to get 200 summary judgments? Just, you know, we do have a question on mandamus of clean hands and promptly seeking a remedy.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps I can supplement the record. We did go back to the trial court at various times saying, please rule on our motion to dismiss. And we couldn't get a ruling. And at that point, we have the problem that we had a trial judge who was granting summary judgments and disposing most of the case on summary judgments.
Why is that a problem for you?
It's not a problem, but it becomes a problem if all of a sudden we decide to mandamus the trial court to rule on a pending motion. I mean, so to speak, when the judge is ruling your way, you don't. It's not a good practice to irritate them with a mandamus unless that becomes absolutely necessary.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.